Hello, and welcome to The Turbulent World, with me, James M. Dorsey, as your host. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's walls are caving in. Mr. Netanyahu's multiple battles fall into two categories: keeping his increasingly fragile government in place, and fighting a war he has already lost in the court of public opinion, and possibly on the ground in Gaza, if measured by the Prime Minister's war goals. On Monday, Israel suffered its most significant international setback since 2016, with the U.S. allowing the United Nations Security Council to call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. In 2016, the United States abstained in a council vote that condemned Israeli settlement activity. The U.S.-Gaza vote strains Israel's relations with the United States, its main backer, that prevented the Security Council from demanding a ceasefire for the past 6 months, as well as Europe and most of the rest of the international community. The bilateral relation with the U.S. suffered a serious blow, said former Israeli Foreign Minister Director General Alon Liel. He said the same is true for Europe, with European Security Council members voting in favor of a ceasefire. There should be no doubt, the U.S. is signaling Bibi that his house is on fire and he should not take the U.S. for granted, added Martin Indyk, a former U.S. ambassador to Israel and U.S. Middle East peace negotiator. Mr. Indyk was referring to Mr. Netanyahu by his nickname. U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfeld controversially attempted to soften the blow by declaring the resolution non-binding, even though UN Security Council resolutions are legally binding and constitute international law. In doing so, Mrs. Thomas-Greenfeld was also trying to create a buffer against likely pressure on the United States to sanction Israel if it refuses to abide by the resolution. Even so, the Biden administration is reviewing whether Israel is complying with a U.S. National Security Memorandum issued last month that requires foreign governments to provide credible guarantees they will not violate human rights with weapons purchased from the United States and will not impede or restrict the delivery of U.S. humanitarian assistance. In response to the vote, Mr. Netanyahu canceled a visit to Washington by an Israeli delegation headed by Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer at the request of U.S. President Joe Biden to discuss Israel's planned offensive in Rafah, the southern Gazan city that is home to more than 1 million Palestinians displaced by the war. With Defense Minister Yoav Gallant already meeting with senior U.S. officials in Washington in a separate visit, Mr. Netanyahu's defiance is largely symbolic. Nevertheless, Mr. Gallant, responding to the UN vote, warned that Israel will act against Hamas everywhere, even in areas where we have not been yet. Mr. Gallant stopped short of naming potential target countries, but Qatar, the main ceasefire and prisoner exchange mediator, and Turkey are likely to top the list. Israel has accused Qatar, home to several exiled Hamas leaders, of funding Hamas, although the U.S. and Israel acquiesced in their presence in the Gulf state to maintain a back channel with the group. Mr. Netanyahu for years solicited Qatari funding in a bid to prevent a breakdown of law and order in Gaza and keep the Palestinian polity split between Hamas and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's Palestine Authority divided. The Middle East Media Research Institute, or MEMRI, founded by Yigal Karmon, a former advisor to Israel's West Bank and Gaza Occupation Authority, and Prime Ministers Yitzhak Shamir and Yitzhak Rabin, has produced in recent months a series of reports designed to bolster Israeli denunciations of Qatar. This week, MEMRI took Qatar to task for hosting the Doha-based Muslim Brotherhood Affiliated International Union of Muslim Scholars, or IUMS. Palestinian and Jordanian members of the union have called on their compatriots to join the fight against Israel and the Jews, with protests and uprisings against autocratic rulers who allegedly enable Israel's war, a reference to Arab countries that have diplomatic relations with Israel. The clerics also urged Arab militaries to come to the support of their Palestinian brethren. Meanwhile, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Bill Russell warned in a readout of a phone call with Israeli foreign ministry officials earlier this month that the Israelis seemed oblivious to the fact that they are facing major, possibly generational damage to their reputation, not just in the region, but elsewhere in the world. We are concerned that the Israelis are missing the forest for the trees and are making a major strategic error in writing off their reputation damage. Add to this the fact that the evolution of the war in recent weeks and running battles with Palestinian fighters in the West Bank suggests that even if the fighting ends today, Israel is looking at an insurgency in Gaza and the West Bank for the foreseeable future, unless a ceasefire is linked to a credible effort to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The U.S. intelligence community last month predicted that Israel probably will face lingering armed resistance from Hamas for years to come, and the military will struggle to neutralize Hamas's underground infrastructure, which allows insurgents to hide, regain strength, and surprise Israeli forces. In Gaza, the Israeli military increasingly is fighting in places it initially occupied and then withdrew from in the belief that it had defeated Hamas. Battles in recent days in and around Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis and Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City erupted in areas Israel earlier said had been cleared of Palestinian fighters. In addition, Hamas, hours before the UN vote, launched for the first time in 2 months rockets at the Israeli port city of Ashdod. Israel's seeming inability 6 months into the war to defeat Hamas, despite dealing its severe body blows, is compounded by its incapability or unwillingness to maintain law and order in Gaza, its effort to undermine, for political rather than security reasons, the United Nations Relief and Welfare Agency, the predominant humanitarian organization in the Strip, and its refusal to allow unfettered humanitarian supplies to enter the territory. The power vacuum created by Israeli military tactics and policy reinforces Hamas's resilience and its ability to return to areas vacated by Israeli forces. Taken together, the UN setback and the evolution of the war contradict Mr. Netanyahu's assertions that Israel is achieving its war goals, including destroying Hamas, freeing more than 100 remaining hostages kidnapped by the group in its October 7 attack on Israel, and ensuring that Gaza no longer serves as a launching pad for Palestinian resistance. Mr. Netanyahu will have been heartened by the insistence in response to the UN resolution of Mr. Gallant and Benny Gantz, a member of the War Cabinet, that Israel will continue the war until its goals have been realized. Nevertheless, the UN resolution weakens Israel's negotiating position in talks mediated by Qatar, the United States, and Egypt to secure a ceasefire and an exchange of the hostages for Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. The resolution, in effect, also constitutes an attempt to force negotiating parties to reach agreement in the next 2 weeks by demanding an immediate ceasefire for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan that would end on April 10, but lead to a lasting, sustainable ceasefire. While most Security Council members will read the resolution's demand for the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages, as a reference to the Hamas-held hostages, it allows Hamas and others to interpret the clause as also including Palestinians in Israeli prisons. The claim would be substantiated by the ongoing ceasefire negotiations and Israel's past willingness to exchange prisoners. Israeli officials said before the UN vote that Mr. Netanyahu had accepted a U.S. compromise proposal to raise the number of Palestinian prisoners that Israel would free in exchange for hostages. The official said Israel was waiting for Hamas to respond. Mr. Netanyahu is under pressure from weekly mass protests demanding his resignation and the government's prioritization of the release of the hostages, even if that involves an end to the war. Speaking to Al Jazeera, Hamas political bureau member Bassem Naim welcomed the UN call for a ceasefire, but insisted that what we are negotiating is not about hostages. We are negotiating about a total ceasefire and total Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. Mr. Naim went on to say, "It is not just about hostages. We have 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, which we consider hostages. If we talk about hostages, it has to be hostages from both sides." In a statement, Hamas said it was ready to engage in immediate prisoner swaps on both sides. Mr. Netanyahu's UN setback came as the Prime Minister's government was balancing on the edge of a cliff. Although unrelated, opposition politician Gideon Saar, who together with Mr. Gantz joined Mr. Netanyahu's emergency unity government formed after Hamas's October 7 attack, resigned because the Prime Minister had refused to include him in the war cabinet. Mr. Saar's departure does not deprive the government of its majority in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. But Mr. Netanyahu's domestic woes don't stop there. Mr. Gantz threatened to leave the government if the Knesset passed a bill in a vote scheduled for next Monday that would exempt ultra-Orthodox Jews from military service. Mr. Gantz also voiced opposition to the bill that Mr. Netanyahu is still tinkering with in a bid to prevent his government from falling apart. Israel's Supreme Court has demanded the government lift an exemption of the ultra-Orthodox as a matter of equality in conscription. Ultra-Orthodox men of military age have for decades avoided the draft by enrolling in yeshivas or religious seminaries. The Israeli military said 66,000 young ultra-Orthodox men had been exempted from military service in the past year. Gallant isn't that bothered by the ultra-Orthodox dodging the draft. But with the government failing to set clear objectives for the Gaza war, his only alternative is to try to engineer the coalition's downfall, said prominent Israeli journalist Anshul Pfeffer. Gallant seems to have reached the unavoidable conclusion that with the current governing coalition, not only will there be no equality of service, but more immediately, the war cannot be prosecuted. Benjamin Netanyahu's incessant efforts to provoke a crisis in Israel's relationship with the United States, the cynical use of the Rafah operation that the Israel Defense Force is in no rush to embark on, and his refusal to even discuss a realistic day after plan for Gaza, are all preventing the Israel Defense Force from planning the next month of the war, Mr. Pfeffer said. Mr. Gantz's threat potentially puts Mr. Netanyahu between a rock and a hard place. Ultra-Orthodox politicians, including United Toward Judaism leader and housing minister Yitzhak Goldknopf, warned that even if one real yeshiva student has to close his Talmud, there will be no government. The Talmud is a primary source of Jewish law and theology. However, the two men said they may accept the enlistment of ultra-Orthodox young men who are not religious scholars. Thank you for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed today's column and podcast. The Turbulent World with James M. Dorsey depends on the support of its readers. For the past 12 years, I have maintained free distribution as a way of maximizing impact. I'm determined to keep it that way. However, to avoid putting up a paywall, I need the support of a core of voluntary paid subscribers to cover the cost of producing the column and podcast. If you believe that the column and podcast add value to your understanding and that of the broader public, please consider becoming a paid subscriber. You can do so by clicking on Substack on the subscription button at www.jamesmdorsey.substack.com and choosing one of the subscription options. Thank you. Take care and best wishes.